This episode of Tales from Ostlantis is brought to you by Ostlantis Premium. Don't you just hate having your favorite podcast interrupted by ads like this? Well, dear listener, you're in luck. Because starting at just $3 a month, you can support independent Chicano media and receive ad-free episodes, premium episodes, bonus content, and access to our Discord server. Just visit talesfromostlantis.com and click Go Premium, or follow the link in the show notes. And now, on with the show.
You must excuse me. I've grown quite weary.
This hasn't been easy, I know. But you've learned a lesson. A lesson in honesty. Honesty to yourself and honesty to others. That lesson will stand you in good stead all your life.
I think we've all learned a good lesson. I've always heard that honesty is the best policy. Now I'm catching on to why that's so,
Yalinochime, and welcome to Tales from Ostlantis, the show where we explore Mesoamerican pseudo-history, New Age nonsense, and other stories of adventure. We are your hosts, Curly Tlapoyawa.
And Ruben Arellano, also known as Tlacatecat.
Episode 4, The Declaration of Cuauhtémoc. The years following the Mexican Revolution saw an upsurge in a form of nationalism characterized by the exaltation of Mexico's indigenous past. As a result, Cuauhtémoc, the last sovereign Tlahtuani of the Mexica Empire, was elevated to a symbol of national pride and unity. The Declaration of Cuauhtémoc is a text in Nahuatl that has been circulated since the late 1960s within the Mexicayot movement, where it holds the status of a foundational and prophetic document. This movement claims that it is the final decree given by Cuauhtémoc prior to the fall of Mexico Tenochtitlan on August 13, 1521. Allegedly, this message was memorized and spread throughout Mesoamerica by a series of runners and has subsequently been passed down via oral tradition to this day. However, it is the position of this show that the text actually dates from the mid-20th century and is best understood as part of the mythologizing of Cuauhtémoc in his role as cultural hero. Nonetheless, analysis of the text, its origins, and the means of its circulation provide important insight into the formation of contemporary folklore in the context of nationalist movements. It can be said that the figure of Cuauhtémoc is the embodiment of indigenous nationalism in Mexico. The son of Ahuitzot, the eighth Tlahtuani of the Mexica Empire, Cuauhtémoc was only 20 years old when he was elected Tlahtuani following the death of Cuitláhuac in 1520. It was Cuauhtémoc who led the final defensive stand of Mexico Tenochtitlan against the combined might of Hernán Cortés' Spanish forces and an indigenous army. It should come as no surprise then that the image of Cuauhtémoc has come to symbolize the resilience and resistance of the Mexican nation. During the Porfiriato, Mexico's intellectuals sought to integrate the indigenous people into the Mexican national identity. Though, as historian Christopher Fulton notes,
in most expressions of the time, the Indian was regarded in romantic terms, not as an important actor in his own right, but as a primeval source of the mestizo race, which was understood as the progressive agent in the nation's history.
In the hands of Porfirian elites, Mexico's indigenous past was celebrated at the expense of its living indigenous communities. This view of Mexico's indigenous people underscored the formation of cultural nationalism from the Porfiriato through the 1970s. This view is made all the more pronounced when we consider that Porfirio Díaz himself was known to powder his face white in an attempt to conceal his indigenous features. The policy of indigenismo grew under the presidency of Lázaro Cárdenas and the slogan, Mexicanize Indians, don't Indianize Mexico, became the rallying cry of the day. On September 26, 1949, Mexican archaeologist Eulalia Guzmán excavated the church at Ixcatiopan, Guerrero. She had been sent to investigate claims that the body of Cuauhtémoc had been buried there in the 16th century by none other than Motolonía himself. Following clues contained in documents belonging to Salvador Juárez, Guzmán recovered a collection of bones located under the altar of the church. Guzmán determined that the bones were authentic, and news quickly spread that the tomb of the young Tlahtuani had indeed been discovered, sparking celebrations across the Mexican countryside. Ultimately, a grand commission was formed by INAH to verify the authenticity of the bones, and they concluded that the entire event was an elaborate hoax perpetrated by Salvador Juárez himself. Guzmán was ostracized by the archaeological community for her sloppy fieldwork and most likely went to her grave thinking that she had, in fact, found Cuauhtémoc's bones. A shrine to Cuauhtémoc was established at the church, his alleged bones on prominent display for all to see. The town of Ixcatiopan remains the destination for a yearly pilgrimage where hundreds gather to commemorate and honor Cuauhtémoc to this day. The mythologizing of Cuauhtémoc took a leap forward with the appearance of the alleged Declaration of Cuauhtémoc. The first printed appearance of the Declaration is found in the October 30th, 1967 issue of Iscalot, a periodical published by the organization known as the Movimiento Confederado Restaurador de la Cultura de Anáhuac, or the MCRCA. As has been previously discussed on this show, this organization was established in the late 1950s by Rodolfo Nieva López with the intention of reclaiming an indigenous Mexican identity and reestablishing the glory of pre-conquest Mexico. And while I can certainly sympathize with these objectives, the approach taken by the MCRCA to accomplish them has proven to be grounded in fantasy rather than reality. The membership of the MCRCA is well known for producing highly questionable scholarship, containing a bizarre mixture of pseudo-history, mysticism, and rabid xenophobia. Much like Afrocentrists who promote a highly inaccurate and distorted view of African history, the MCRCA presented an image of Mesoamerica that had very little to do with historical fact. In the MCRCA version of Mexican history, Nahuatl culture is preeminent above all others and responsible for much of world civilization. According to the MCRCA, the ancient Nahuatl people traveled to Egypt, where they introduced concepts such as pyramid building and aspects of Nahuatl cosmovision, things which are completely impossible, by the way. These beliefs were circulated via their official publication, Iscalot, as well as the book Mexicayot, published in 1969. For those unfamiliar with the Declaration of Cuauhtémoc, we will present the text as it appears in the book Mexicayot, published by the MCRCA, along with translations and an analysis by our colleague, Dr. Magnus Farrell Hansen, in the show notes for this episode. So if you want to read the Declaration and a more in-depth analysis of it by a, you know, PhD in linguistics who also speaks Nahuatl, check out the show notes. The MCRCA adopted the romanticized figure of the Aztec warrior as the core symbol of Mexican ethnic identity. And the group had its main influence in urban, middle, and working class communities. Its practices mixed Mexican nationalism, neo-Aztec religion, also prominently influenced by New Age ideas, the use and promotion of the classical Nahuatl language, including the practitioners taking Nahuatl names, and a new form of Aztec dance. In his book, Nieva López claims that the Declaration of Cuauhtémoc was revealed to him by Estanislao Ramírez Ruiz. a chemical engineer from Tláhuac and a participant in the investigation of Cuauhtémoc's alleged tomb at Ixcatiopan, and that Ramírez had himself received the tradition from his parents. Nieva López adds that he wrote it down with the help of Nahuatl speakers from Tepoztlán and the Huasteca. Now, if the declaration was indeed passed along to Nieva López by Estanislao Ramírez, why is it never mentioned in any of the documents written by or about Ramírez? Also worth mentioning is the notable absence of the alleged declaration in any respectable history book or collection of indigenous literature. Surely a work of such profound historical significance would merit a place in scholarship dealing with the fall of Mexico Tenochtitlan. Also, why wait until after Ramírez had died to reveal the declaration? These questions alone are enough to cast doubt upon the declaration's authenticity. Now, just for brevity's sake, we're not going to go through Dr. Hansen's entire linguistic analysis, but I would like to present four main points that Magnus found.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Have you picked up your Mexica calendar for the year 12 Flint? Or how about a paperback copy of The Four Disagreements? Just visit talesfromaztlantis.com for all the latest merchandise and show some love for your favorite podcast. That's talesfromaztlantis.com for all the latest merchandise. Now, back to the show.
Point one. The Nahuatl text is a translation of the Spanish text and not the reverse. Point two. The translator was not a native Nahuatl speaker, but had probably studied some classical Nahuatl and occasionally used a colonial dictionary in producing the translation. Point three. Many word forms are different from their forms in colonial Nahuatl and suggest that the translator may have been familiar with a 20th century colloquial variety of Nahuatl, or that the translator may have had help from native speakers to help with the translation of specific parts of the Spanish original. The arbitrary division of words also suggests that the translator, after hearing them from an oral source, perhaps a native speaker, wrote down the phrase by phrase or word by word direct translations. Point four. The entire grammatical and syntactic structure of the text is atypical for both colonial and modern Nahuatl, and it does not show either the rhetorical traits commonly associated with early colonial Nahuatl oratory or the kind of formulaic language that would suggest an oral source of transmission, e.g. repetition, simple short phrases, topic, comment, cohesion.
Consequently, we can conclude that the text was most likely not passed down through oral tradition directly from Cuauhtémoc, but that it was probably produced in southern Mexico by Rodolfo Nieva López and Estanislao Ramírez with the aid of some of their Nahuatl-speaking associates in the 1960s. While many cultural educators and practitioners of Aztec dance may certainly draw inspiration from the alleged declaration, it is without historical merit. Further distribution of the document is discouraged, as doing so only encourages the propagation of pseudo-history and ignores the actual cultural inheritance of Mexico's indigenous people. If we truly desire a powerful message of resistance and resilience passed down by our ancestors, personally, I highly recommend that the declaration be replaced with the following excerpt from Alvarado de Sosomoc's Crónica Mexicayu, as this message is far more inspiring, and most importantly, it is not a work of fiction.
Thus they have come to tell it. Thus they have come to record it in their narration. And for us, they have painted it in their codices, the ancient men, the ancient women. They were our grandfathers, our grandmothers, our great-grandfathers, great-grandmothers, our great-great-grandfathers, our ancestors. Their account was repeated. They left it to us. They bequeathed it forever to us who live now, to us who come from them. Never will it be lost. Never will it be forgotten, that which they came to do, that which they came to record in their paintings, their renown, their history, their memory. Thus in the future, never will it perish. Never will it be forgotten. Always we will treasure it. We, their children, their grandchildren, brothers, great-grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren, descendants, we who carry their blood and their color, we will tell it. We will pass it on to those who do not yet live, who are yet to be born, the children of the Mexicans, the children of the Tenochcans.
I got to admit, this one hurt. Like, I really wanted this to be real when I was young. Like,
I think we all did. I mean, we've kind of had discussions about this off and on over the years. And you know, this is one of those that was very inspirational to a lot of us young Chicanos, and, you know, especially those of us that came of age in the 90s, you know, during the sort of the renewal of the Chicano, the brief renewal of the Chicano movement, you know, I think, as we've discussed before briefly, and, you know, the Zapatistas in 94, and then the response to the 1992 quincentennial celebrations of Columbus, and all the uproar that ensued because of these celebrations. And I think going back to the 80s and even going back to the 70s, you had people who were already sort of promoting these ideas that are sort of tied to a sense of like a prophetic vision, right? I mean,
yeah,
that's what the Declaration was. It's sort of like a promise, a prophecy of sorts, that one day we will rise again. Sound familiar, you know? So, I, you know, in fact, I was doing some research on this alleged prophecy that I've heard since I was a kid about the return of, you know, brown people to Aztlan, and how, you know, we're supposed to be reclaiming this land, and how we're doing it just by sheer numbers of people immigrating from Mexico and other parts of, you know, Central and South America. And at one point, I think we thought that perhaps that story dated to maybe the 80s or the 70s. Mm-hmm. But I think I've found some. Our good friend Ernesto Mireles, in his book recently published called Insurgent Aztlan, he talks about the prophecy of how brown people are supposed to return to Aztlan. And there's a quote in his book that he takes from a movie called Please Don't Bury Me Alive in 1972. And in that movie, there's a brother who went to fight, I believe, in Vietnam, and then there's one that stays behind. And Alejandro is the one that stayed behind. And he recalls this quote about a so-called prophecy that's supposed to be fulfilled. And part of the prophecy goes like this. The Indians have a prophecy that says one day their descendants of brown skin will re-inhabit all that the white men took, what they called Aztlan. I just want to be around when it happens.
So this never dates, heard of that movie.
Yeah, this dates to 1972. So it's only if you do the math from 1967, when the declaration was first revealed, to 72. How many years is that? What, 5 years?
Yeah, it's not long.
It's not long, right? So there's something there. There's some kind of transmission that's going on immediately after this declaration is revealed, supposedly.
Well, when did people like Tlacaelel and Florencio Yescas and Andres Segura, when did they really start coming up?
Well, that's Yeah, that's a complicated story. I mean, based on my research, Florencio Yescas, really, his first entradas, for lack of a better term, into the U.S. was, I mean, you can date it back to the 50s.
Really?
I mean, yeah, I have found, and others have documented this, and I think he also expressed it to some of his students, Mario Aguilar, who's written a dissertation about his experience in danza, being one of the first danzantes that danced with Flo. I think he also mentions that Yescas told him about his initial forays into the U.S. going back to the 50s, but he wasn't like doing danza like the way we know it. He was coming up, making money, you know, dancing in different like dance troupes and
like can-can shows and stuff.
Yeah,
right?
That sort of stuff, right? Cabarets, because he was doing it for the money, right? He was here to make some money.
And he was a classically trained dancer, right?
Exactly. And so when he really starts coming up to teach danza tradicional, is probably in the early 70s, like 70, 71, 72, right around the time that this movie came out.
Yeah, so there was definitely a like a conduit, or there was definitely a way that this information was able to be transmitted, you know, prior to the internet, prior to, you know, emails. There were people coming back and forth at this time that could have been putting this information out.
In fact, there was an organization called the White Roots of Peace. I briefly talk about it in my dissertation. I don't really do too much with it because it would have taken me to a whole different direction. But the White Roots of Peace, if I'm not mistaken, that was an organization that was started by members of the Iroquois tribe, and how they were trying to sort of spread the message of going back to their prophetic, I forget what they call him, like a not like a god, but like a sort of a prophet, Deganawira, I believe that's what they call him, and so they were trying to spread that message of you know, coming back to the traditions, right? It's sort of like a return to tradition. A way to sort of rehabilitate a lot of the urban Indians who had lost their way after they had been removed from reservations and forced onto the urban centers, and how there was that disconnect between the younger generations who were, you know, starting to be born in the 60s and 70s. And so this organization goes back to, if I'm not mistaken, they started sometime in the late 50s and throughout the 60s. What they would do is they would go to Mexico, or they would contact indigenous people in Mexico. And I think they made contact with danzantes. And what they were trying to do is they were trying to, it was like the beginnings of the pan-indigenous movement, sort of, right? And say that they would bring danzantes. And in fact, Andres Segura, you know, the other gentleman that introduced danza to the U.S., his first entries into the U.S. date to the late 60s, and he started the first Xinashtli danza group in San Antonio in, I believe, 67 or 68, and he came up with the White Roots of Peace.
And so
they would go around the country doing shows at universities, at local rec centers, at churches, whoever would have them, like local community spaces, because they were trying to reach the urban indigenous population. And they were beginning to also sort of incorporate, you know, because of the Chicano movement, you know, they were beginning to make these connections with Chicanos who were interested in indigeneity. And so I think that somewhere along the lines, this message of the Declaration of Cuauhtémoc and this idea of a prophecy of the return to Aztlán sort of begins to take hold, and you get a merging of traditions between Mexico and what the Chicano movement was trying to promote. And so this prophecy sort of emerges from that. And I think it's connected to the consigna. I mean, I have no proof at this point because I don't have any actual sources, but just thinking about these things makes me wonder if there's some connection right there.
Well, it was all going on at the same time, right? And it was a lot of the same people that were associated with the consigna and the birth of danza. So I think you're onto something there, Dr. Arellano. I think that's worth looking into further and investigating.
Absolutely.
But the thing with the declaration that, you know, when I dropped out of high school and saved up money, and then I went to Mexico, right? And when I was there, I was basically like full on Mexicayot. And I remember, if you go to the Zócalo, right by the Templo Mayor Museum, there's this art piece on the wall that has the Declaration of Cuauhtémoc on it.
I've seen it on Google Streets or whatever that's called.
Yeah, you can look it up. And to me, so I thought that that gave it like this air of validity, right? Like, this made it legitimized it in my eyes.
Because it's being sanctioned by the state somehow, right?
It's up on a wall. It's right by the Templo Mayor Museum. It's in between the Templo Mayor Museum and the cathedral right there in the Zócalo. So you could go look at it and read it. And that, I was like, oh, well, it must be real, right? I mean, they wouldn't put it on a wall if it wasn't real. And when I got back to the United States, I dug through history books and I dug through all these different books on Mexico. I couldn't find it anywhere. And, you know, I was a pretty hardcore believer at the time. So I think I just kind of made an excuse of, oh, well, maybe they just didn't know about it, or, you know, but they're trying to keep it a secret, man.
Yeah.
You know, and it wasn't until later, when we started talking, we really started questioning these things around the same time. And like, man, I bet you the Declaration's a bunch of bullshit.
Yeah, you know, the first time that I was exposed to it was probably, and I think we talked about this briefly before, Lowrider Magazine, they used to have a column by Roberto Rodriguez.
It was like the Raza Report or something.
Something like that, who now goes by the name of Dr. Simply, I believe. And I want to say that, I don't know if it was one of his pieces or someone else that was under the same kind of column, but I do remember like reading that, or an idea of it, or the Consigna de Cuauhtémoc, or hearing it mentioned. But I don't think I was really ever exposed to the entirety of what, you know, the consigna says, the entire, you know, declaration itself, until I met you and I met our good friend Evelio Flores in the Danza here in Dallas. And I think you were one of the first people that I remember that was handing out a lot of literature on Mexicayot.
Yeah.
And one of those pamphlets that you gave me had the entire speech on it, right? And it was very impressive, right? But, you know, it's like you said, you know, after a while, you begin to dig a little deeper. And, you know, people like me and you, like, we're like, okay, what is the source of this? If it's true that Cuauhtémoc is the author, and that if it's true that, as the story goes, that he pronounced this declaration the night before he surrendered and Tenochtitlan fell to the Spanish, which would have been on the night of August, what, the 12th?
Right? Yeah, the night of the 12th, and then the 13th is when it fell.
When it fell. And so, and then, you know, when you ask, well, how come, like you were saying, how come this isn't in the history books? How come we've never really heard this in the official story of, you know, the fall of Tenochtitlan, et cetera, et cetera? And then when we would ask people, like in our danza circles, respectively, like the common answer, and I'm sure people listening to this that have heard this before you know, this will sound familiar to you. You know, you get the same refrain. It's like, oh, well, it was hidden, you know, by elders. And, you know, it was foretold that one day it would be revealed at the proper time to the right people, yada, yada, yada. There's always this secret, right? There's always this mystery. There's always the sort of secretive group of elders that has like the knowledge that they're holding.
You know. And it's a common trope within like New Age movements too.
Exactly.
You know, we got this information from a secret council of elders, and then you are actively discouraged from investigating it further or questioning it. Or, you know, and the way they did this in the Mexicayot was you know, you're explicitly told. When I was in Mexico, I was explicitly told you cannot trust anthropologists. You cannot trust archaeologists. Exactly. You cannot trust historians. Well, then who can I trust? You can trust us. And we have a secret knowledge. And it's very culty, you know?
It is.
It's like, well, wait a minute. How come I can't question these teachings? Like they tell you specifically to your face. And when I lived there, when I came back, and it's the reason I had all this literature to hand out, is I was specifically given the task. Like they told me, Kurli, you know, when you get back, it's your job to spread Mexicayot.
You know what I like to call it? Because I did the same thing after you left. You left me with a lot of original copies of material. And what I would do is I would make like booklets. Like I would staple stuff together and just hand it out everywhere I went. Yeah. I like to call that phase of my Mexica identity and life born again Mexica.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because that's basically what it is. You're born again, whatever, Christian or what have you. Like you are adamant and passionate about what you're doing, and you want to spread the gospel to the world.
And you want to be the most hardcore, right?
And you get upset because people don't listen and they're not accepting the truth that you have to share with them. It's very, I mean, going back to what you were saying, it's very culty. Very culty.
It really is. And that's how I kind of, you know, I'm not comparing myself to Malcolm X, but I could kind of understand how Malcolm X felt when he left the Nation of Islam, when he realized like, man, these guys don't know what the hell they're talking about. Like, this is a bunch of bullshit. This isn't Islam.
No, that's why it's the Nation of Islam. Get it right, man.
Yeah, exactly.
No, but what I was going to, I wanted to go back to this idea. Let's, for the sake of argument, let's say that it's true that this declaration was spoken by Cuauhtémoc the night before the fall of Tenochtitlan. And let's say, let's continue this argument, and let's say that it's true that I guess he must have only spoken it to a select few that could hear him, because otherwise the word would have spread far and wide. And so let's say that there was a select group of chosen people, for lack of a better term, right, that were supposed to guard this declaration and then pass it down over the generations. Right. You would think that at some point someone would have said, well, maybe now is the time to share this in 500 years.
Right.
Right. Like it doesn't take that long before someone has that urge and that itch to say, hey, wait, I know this thing. There's the secret that I have. And, you know, it was told to me by my grandfather. And
especially
he told it to me for a reason, because I think maybe I'm the one that needs to reveal it now.
Yeah. Well, especially considering the absolute hell that the entire, you know, indigenous people of Mexico were going through following the conquest.
Right.
At some point in time.
That would have been very inspirational.
Yeah, exactly. You would have wanted to have been like, hey, guys, it's going to be okay.
Right.
And here is why. Because Tata Cuauhtémoc said this.
Yeah, he left us a roadmap on how to handle this, what's happening to us right now.
And nobody did that. So
no one. And what, 1967? What's so special about that year? What was going on?
Well,
seriously, because the massacre at Tlatelolco happens the following year, right? And then
the Rejinos start.
Well, but also coincidentally, Nieva Lopez dies shortly after the massacre, or was it before? But he died that same year. And because of all the political turmoil, his sister Iscalotzi and other people who were part of the MCRCA, who were his, like, you know, fervent followers, they believe that the government had assassinated him, because I don't know if you recall this, but he was running for president under the MCRCA.
Yeah, the MCRCA was a political party.
They were
operating as a political party.
And so for a long time, a lot of his followers going up into the late 70s, early 80s, when Lina Odena Güemes did her analysis of the MCRCA and Nieva Lopez, when she was interviewing people, a lot of them like revealed to her that they still held true to the belief that the government had assassinated Nieva Lopez for his political beliefs, and because they think, in their perception, that he was gaining ground and could have possibly won the presidency, right? So that that's a year after the declaration is revealed. And then in 1970, what happens in 1970? There was I'm missing the date here because it's 67, 68, or 69. 69. What happens in 69? You have the conference in Denver, right? With Alorista and Corky and El Plan Espiritual de Aztlán, and so you know you have to wonder like, what is the connection running here with all of these things? Because shortly after that, you get a burst of indigenous energy that begins to take hold throughout Aztlan.
This year, August 13th, 2021, is the 500th year anniversary of the fall of Mexico Tenochtitlan.
That's right.
And I suspect we're going to be hearing a lot of this declaration being read at Mexica events, or, you know, online at least. People are going to be reposting this all over the place, audio recordings, because it is very inspirational and it's very impressive when you hear it. But I really encourage our listeners to cast a critical eye on it.
They first reveal the MCRCA and the other reveal the consigna through their newsletter, Iscalo, in 1967. Right. And then it's also published in 1969 in the book Mexicayot, which is a year after Nieva has passed already. And they took the name Mexicayot from the source that was written in the 16th century by Tezozómoc, who calls his Mexicayot. And the passage that you very adeptly were able to correlate with what sounded like the consigna comes straight from the Mexicayot.
Yeah.
So, right, I think, I don't know if you do it, if you did it here or if you've done it recently, but I remember in, some years past that you were making the comparison how you thought that perhaps the consigna was modeled directly from those words that you suggest should be replaced with the consigna, right? Am I correct on that?
Yeah, yeah.
But also going back to this idea of the celebration, the 500 celebration this year, I mean, considering who the president of Mexico is now, do you think that maybe AMLO might come out?
Man, he might, right?
Right. I mean,
have a televised event where he gets up and he reads. He might even dress up like Cuauhtémoc and get up there.
Right. Or he might even get a native Nahuatl speaker to do it in Nahuatl.
Yeah, right. Get up there and just with all the pageantry and you know, television and a big budget. And once again, glorify in Mexico's indigenous past, but completely ignore Mexico's indigenous present.
Yeah.
Which seems to be the MO of the Mexican government, right?
If you go back to the origins of Mexican nationalism, I mean, it starts with the criollos. And it starts really with the criollos, who are the sons, well, I would say sons, and maybe not so much the daughters, because it was a very patriarchal society, more so back then than perhaps it still is in today in Mexico, right? But those criollo sons of the great conquistadors, you know, they were beginning to assume that Mexican identity, saying we are from here and we are the inheritors of the next great civilization, as many civilizations that have come and gone on this great land of Anahuac, right? This is before Mexico is Mexico today, right? They're already talking about how they're the next inheritors of the great civilization. You had the, I don't think the Olmec were known back then, but they knew of the Tolteca, they knew of Teotihuacan, they knew of the Maya, and they knew obviously of the Azteca. And so they were trying to compare themselves, the criollos were, saying we're the next in that great line of great civilizations.
This unbroken chain.
Unbroken chain.
Great civilizations. Right.
And so that's where it comes from. And so this idea of looking to the past to legitimize yourself in power in the present is you know, a Mexican tradition that goes back to the colonial period. You know?
Yeah, and it's rooted in, like we were saying, pseudo-history, right? They're rewriting
exactly.
history. They're misrepresenting history. They're distorting what actually happened.
Distorting it, misrepresenting, exactly.
In order to advance a very specific political nationalist agenda. And
right.
the thing that, you know, so I get a lot of people in the Mexicayot who, you know, obviously they get very angry when I tell them, you know, that a lot of the stuff that we were led to believe is actually false. They react very emotionally. And one thing that I don't think they're ready to reconcile is the fact that the MCRCA was extremely xenophobic, was ultra nationalistic, was basically racist. You know,
they were also kind of Nazi sympathizers.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, how do you reconcile that? Just because it makes you feel good?
The way that they reconcile it is by the fact that they're oblivious as to who the MCRCA really were, if they even know who they were to begin with. A lot of the Entente Zahara people on this so-called Mexicayot Red Road or what have you have never heard of the MCRC, have never heard of Nieva López.
Yeah,
right.
That's true.
And so they take the consigna, and then after you tell them where it comes from, who, you know, it didn't just get revealed by this, you know, council of elders through the organic tradition of danza or whatever you want to call it. It was actually a political organization that revealed there's a source. We have found the source, right? They've been telling us who they are.
Yeah. And we know their agenda. We know
they've never been shy about what they were up to. Right.
Yeah.
Just because you didn't know about it doesn't mean that it didn't exist or it didn't happen. I mean, we can only lead people to the facts, and it's up to you to decide if you want to accept them. But, you know, the facts are what they are. You can't argue the facts.
You can
choose to ignore them. You can choose to dismiss them, but it doesn't mean that those facts don't exist.
Yeah, that's the great thing, you know. It's true whether or not you want to believe it.
Exactly.
And with that, dear listeners, we will bid you farewell. Thank you for listening to another episode of Tales from Aztlantis. We are your host, Curly Tlapoyawa.
And Tlacateca.
Until next time, remember, the truth doesn't always taste good.
But it comes from elders.
Thank you for listening to Tales from Aztlantis, a project of the Chimali Institute of Mesoamerican Arts. If you enjoy the show, please consider becoming a Patreon supporter. You can do this by visiting talesfromaztlantis.com and clicking Support the Podcast. Your continued support will help keep the podcast ad-free and independent. Until next time, Timo Itase.